This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming to our annual Fulton Lecture. As a preliminary matter, there are three words of thanks that I wanted to say, and perhaps you could help me in thanking those who ought to be thanked. The first is that we have this year been under the able hands in organizing the Fulton Lecture of my new colleague, relatively new colleague, Professor Allison LaCroix, and I'm grateful to her for all the organization. It won't surprise you to know that Allison not only had a hand in choosing Professor Casper as our speaker, but perhaps we can either blame her or credit her for the footnotes that go along with the speech as well. But thank you very much for organizing it. And sitting right next to her, and also to be thanked, is Maureen Sheehan, who has taken great charge and ingenuity even in taking control and improving our conferences and lectures and things of that sort as we aim to do more at the law school. So thank you, Maureen. The more conventional thanks are even more fun to give, and they go to the Fulton family, and especially to Muriel and Maury Fulton, who are with us. I know it's the Fulton Lecture, in case I forget when I come in, and there they are in exactly the same seats in the room. It's sort of like students in a class that have their favorite spot. I think, knowing them as I do, that they're just waiting until the year when the lecturer calls on them and engages in the Socratic method. But that hasn't happened yet, and we'll just see what happens. But I'm glad you could all be here with us, and thank you very much for having the foresight to make all this possible. And that brings me, with our usual Chicago very short introduction, to our distinguished guests. Professor Gerhard Casper. One has a long list of accomplishments to choose from, and knowing that it's supposed to be a short introduction, the question is which one or two or three does one pick? The safest thing to do is probably to introduce the person by their most distinguished, important, Nobel Prize-winning quality attribute. And so I guess I should start by saying that we're happy to have Gerhard return back home, where he was, after all, Distinguished Service Professor of Law. And so I begin with the highest honor one could possibly have, I guess. It happens that along the way, both before that and after that, there are other distinguished things in the profile. I doubt that people here need to be reminded of them, but we have with us, all in one person, the President Emeritus of Stanford University, a all-purpose and wonderful administrator of our own university in various roles, including previously Dean of the Law School, in which role I first met Gerhard. And that is the, I learned the sort of what makes a Chicago dean different from everyone else, which was the first time we spoke on the phone. Professor Casper, then Dean Casper, was calling to invite me to do something in Chicago. And he began with sort of quintessential Chicago small talk. Not, how are you, or I look forward to meeting you, or we know people in common, or how about those Cubs, or anything of the sort, but rather a complaint about a footnote I had written in an article, obscure article, and engaging me in sort of intellectual conversation, which was very, very flattering for a then junior faculty member. You know, for a long period of time after that, I thought, well, that guy is really clever. He surely never read the article, but it's really smart when you have to read something quickly. Just go look at footnote 28 and then call the person and talk about it. But then, unsurprisingly, and not at all to my chagrin, when I got to know him better, I found out that he really had read that article and many others written by colleagues all over the country. And that is really the way to be a successful academic and leader of other academics. So thank you for that all the way back then. Since leaving Chicago, Professor Casper has learned many things, and I'm not sure which ones we will get little hints of. Here, he shows his expertise in the era of the Founding Fathers, but that's something we knew about from his book written about 10 years ago or so now, I guess. So we know about that distinction. But were he to speak on the nature of undergraduate education, or on bargaining with the federal government about indirect cost recovery and all the moral hazards that creates, or managing a hospital system and how we should get from here to universal health care, or German law and how it's evolved. I mean, in subject after subject that one can think of, it's hard to imagine a better dialogue than one would have but with Professor Casper, and so we look forward to his comments. He is, after all, the quintessential connoisseur of arts and of people and of ideas. And so I give you Professor Gerhard Casper.
Thank you very much, Saul, for this kind introduction. It is such a great pleasure to be back in Chicago at the university. Regina and I spent 26 years of our lives here, most of our adult life, and it was a wonderful period. It is a particular pleasure that there are five deans in this room. One, two, three, four, five. You have five, the five most recent deans of the University of Chicago Law School here. And I cherish their contributions to the law school. Actually, it is, of course, Muriel and Maury. I discovered, doing some research, I'm kind of research-oriented person, I discovered that you established this lecture only in 1988, 1 year after I had left the deanship. You waited clearly for Jeff Stern, but I have forgiven you for that. You may wonder why there is this map of Philadelphia down here. And this is not just any old map of Philadelphia, but it is a map that the law students in 1987, when I left the deanship, presented to the law school in my honor. And it is, of course, Philadelphia at the time of the founding, more or less. And the students from my classes were very much convinced that if I were reborn, I would want to be reborn in the last quarter of the 18th century, and they thought I needed a map. I asked for this map to be displayed here because I will deal indeed with Philadelphia in the last decade of the 18th century today. Is there still a glass menagerie? The glass menagerie used to run cartoons at times. And, of course, my favorite cartoon of myself was one showing me in a late 18th century dress with a wig, and the caption read, "Founding Father." And as founding father, I will now talk to you. My subject is the requirement that new citizens abjure prior allegiances. It was introduced into federal naturalization law in 1795, and it is still the law of the land. A seemingly small historical topic, it provides cause to reflect about changes in the concept of citizenship that have taken place over time, especially in recent decades. The 1795 Act to establish a uniform rule of naturalization provided that an alien, in order to become a citizen, had to have been a resident of the United States for at least 5 years, and had to declare in court 3 years before his admission, on oath or affirmation, that it was bona fide his intention to become a citizen of the United States, and to renounce forever all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty, whatever, and particularly by name, the prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty whereof such alien may at the time be a citizen or subject. The actual forswearance of allegiance took place at the time of naturalization and was to be recorded by the clerk of the court that admitted the applicant to citizenship. At that occasion, it had to appear to the satisfaction of the court that the candidate had behaved as a man of good moral character attached to the principles of the Constitution of the United States and well disposed to the good order and happiness of the same. On oath or affirmation, the applicant had to declare his willingness to support the Constitution of the United States and that he, by the way, always he in these statutes, and of course, indeed, it was the men who became citizens, and their wives became citizens derivatively. This changed only much later, though it has changed, thank God, and it has changed dramatically in every way. He had to declare his willingness to support the Constitution of the United States, and that he did absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to every foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty, whatever, and in particular by name, the prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty, whereof he was before a citizen or subject. These are strong words. The dictionary defines to renounce in terms of giving up in a complete and formal manner, to abandon, cast off, repudiate, absolutely and entirely to renounce and abjure has almost the connotations of the expression to renounce the world. And that, in a way, was what was involved. The juror was asked to renounce the old monarchical world in favor of a new order. The 1795 legislation became a substitute for the 1790 Naturalization Act, the first of its kind at the federal level, that had required only 2 years of residence, good character, not good moral character, and a simple oath to support the Constitution of the United States. James Madison, the sponsor of the revisions that were introduced in December 1794, thought that the 1790 law had not duly guarded against intrusions and evasions, and that the progress of things in Europe was exposing the United States to very serious inconveniences. While we cannot be sure what precisely Madison had in mind when he made these observations, the likeliest explanation is his fear that laws favoring citizens could be subverted by easy naturalization of foreign, especially British, subjects. Earlier in the year, Madison had been engaged in a major, if unsuccessful, effort to promote restrictions on British shipping and trade through sweeping duties on tonnage and imports. In 1798, as the country was supposedly swarming with spies and seditious persons, with both Jacobins and French aristocrats, with vagabonds and wild Irishmen who were reliably voting for the Jeffersonian Republicans, Congress extended the residency requirement for naturalization to 14 years and demanded a formal application 5 years before admission to citizenship. The naturalization legislation of 1798 was part of the package that has become known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. The Act supplementing and amending the 1795 Naturalization Act also introduced a system of registering aliens arriving and residing in the United States that, with varying degrees of intensity and reach, has been with us ever since. 1798 introduced, as it were, the concept of a documented alien. However, in 1802, following the Revolution of 1800, the residence requirements were restored to the length originally set in 1795. the 5-year residency is still the law. The way the political establishment perceived immigration issues in the 1790s, at least there are 4 bottles, so it will last me, and I'm willing to share a bottle with one of you if you get too thirsty. The way the political establishment perceived immigration issues in the 1790s must have been greatly influenced by the fact that the seat of the national government, Philadelphia, was also the leading port of the United States. 40% of all transatlantic passages ended in Philadelphia, with arrivals concentrated in the short May through October sailing season. As a contributor to overall population growth, European emigration to the United States, however, was not a major factor in the 1790s. While the American population at the time expanded considerably, this was primarily due to an extraordinarily high fertility rate and, by comparisons to Europe, relatively benign mortality conditions. At the time of the Revolution, the population of the United States was approximately 2.5 million, not counting Indians, of whom about 500,000 came from Africa. By 1790, it had increased to almost 4 million, about 750,000 blacks. By 1800, the end of the decade I'm interested in, to 5.3 million, with about 1 million blacks. These are very considerable population gains, but in the decade between 1790 and 1799, European emigration to the United States only amounted to about 100,000 arrivals, a rather small figure in the big scheme of things and given the intense political reaction. How homogeneous was the white population of the United States in the 1790s? A decisive majority of Americans were of British origin, especially in the Northeast. New York and New Jersey had sizable Dutch populations. Pennsylvania was 1/3 German, but of course also had significant English, Scottish, and Irish stock. In Georgia, 18% were Scots-Irish. The number of Catholics, while in the tens of thousands, was nevertheless tiny as a percentage of the total population. In spite of his notorious misgivings about Catholics, John Jay, in The Federalist No. 2, described Americans optimistically as homogeneous, as one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government. Others, like Thomas Jefferson, or for that matter, Jefferson's nemesis, Alexander Hamilton, were considerably less confident. The Jefferson of the Notes on the State of Virginia took a dim view of the prospect of integrating immigrants from continental Europe. I quote, "Every species of government has its specific principles. Ours perhaps are more peculiar than those of any other in the universe." American exceptionalism. "It is a composition of the freest principles of the English Constitution with others derived from natural right and natural reason. To these, nothing can be more opposed than the maxims of absolute monarchies. Yet from such, we are to expect the greatest number of emigrants. They will bring with them the principles of the government they leave, imbibed in their early youth. Or if able to throw them off, it will be in exchange for an unbounded licentiousness, passing as is usual from one extreme to another. It would be a miracle were they to stop precisely at the point of temperate liberty. These principles, with their language, they will transmit to their children. In proportion to their numbers, they will share with us the legislation. They will infuse into it their spirit, warp and bias its directions, and render it a heterogeneous, incoherent, distracted mass. Alexander Hamilton, attacking Jefferson in 1802 for proposing liberalization of the 1798 Naturalization Act, not only referred to what Jefferson had said in the Notes on Virginia, but expressed similar sentiments. The influx of foreigners must tend to produce a heterogeneous compound, to change and corrupt the national spirit, to complicate and confound public opinion, to introduce foreign propensities. Thomas Paine, by contrast, while not denying heterogeneity, presented an assessment of the situation that reflected his optimism about the workings of American government. He saw America as made up of people from different nations, accustomed to different forms and habits of government, speaking different languages. But by the simple operation of constructing government on the principles of society and the rights of men, every difficulty retires and all the parts are brought into cordial unison. The dynamics of American democracy would, as it were, take care of the disruptive potential of heterogeneity. The question of how to deal with the prospect of heterogeneity was not easily answered along partisan lines. Though partisan politics clearly played a role not only in 1798, but also in 1802, as can be seen in Jefferson's support for a liberalization of naturalization rules that benefited his party. Aristide Zolberg summarizes American leaders varied considerably in their assessment of whether the political community was still safely homogeneous or verged on unsafe diversity. And this indeterminacy meant that the matter was open to debate and could spawn divergent policies. Underlying the debate was the question of what it means to belong to a people, how allegiance is constituted. Before independence, at the most basic level, the matter was fairly straightforward and non-ideological. As summarized by Lord Cook and Calvin's case, and by the way, Charles Gray is up there, and I just said to Charles when I came into the room that he who has spent a lot of time on Calvin's case working out all the details, that every time I see a reference to Calvin's case anywhere, I immediately think of Charles. Charles, it is a pleasure to have you here. I will be so short on Calvin's case that I cannot possibly make a mistake. As summarized by Lord Cook in Calvin's case, every subject, as soon as he was born, and as a matter of natural law, considered to be part of the laws of England, owed perpetual allegiance and obedience to his sovereign, as the sovereign owed a reciprocal duty to protect. This duty to protect was meant to fulfill the most immediate needs of ordinary people: minimal security against conquest, civil war, anarchy, and private violence. The duty of perpetual allegiance followed from a fact, the accident of birth within the realm, not an act such as a fealty oath. Subjecthood was mostly an involuntary personal characteristic. William Blackstone's account, published only 11 years before the Declaration of Independence, follows Cook's dicta, but with an important twist. Natural allegiance is such as is due from all men born within the king's dominions immediately upon their birth. For immediately upon their birth, they are under the king's protection. Natural allegiance is therefore a debt of gratitude, which cannot be forfeited, cancelled, or altered by any change of time, place, or circumstances, nor by anything but the united concurrence of the legislature. The twist is, of course, the reference to the power of the legislature to alter allegiance. To that rather limited extent, Lockean notions of consent had influenced Blackstone's concept of allegiance. It did, however, not occur to Blackstone that allegiance was a matter of an individual's consent. The passage that I just quoted is preceded by another one in which Blackstone discussed express engagements in feudal law and on the part of officeholders. He then continued, "But besides these express engagements, the law also holds that there is an implied original and virtual allegiance owing from every subject to his sovereign antecedently to any express promise. And although the subject never swore any faith or allegiance in form. For as the king, by the very descent of the crown, is fully invested with all the rights and bound to all the duties of sovereignty before his coronation," a reference in many ways powerfully to the Hanoverians, "so the subject is bound to the prince by an intrinsic allegiance before the superinduction of those outward bounds of oath, homage, and fealty, which were only instituted to remind the subject of this his previous duty and for the better securing his performance. The sanction of an oath, it is true, in case of violation of duty, makes the guilt still more accumulated by superadding perjury to treason. But it does not increase the civil obligation to loyalty. It only strengthens the social tie by uniting it with that of religion. Oaths of supremacy, allegiance, and abjuration in British constitutional history are pertinent in the American context, because the British oaths provided Americans with models once they came to consider them necessary or desirable. A typical example is the oath of supremacy that dates back to the first year of the reign of Elizabeth I, and the taking of which was initially required of ecclesiastical persons as well as office holders, and then by an act of 1562, also of persons with a university education, lawyers and the like. All of you would have had to take this oath. The point of the oath of supremacy in the era of Reformation and ultramontane challenges was the acknowledgement of the Queen's supremacy in all matters, temporal and ecclesiastical, and therefore the denial of papal and other authority in her realm. Its language stressed lack of jurisdiction on the part of any foreign prince, person, prelate, state, or potentate. The juror renounced and forsook all foreign jurisdictions, powers, superiorities, and authorities, and pledged faith and true allegiance to the Queen, her heirs, and lawful successors. At the outset of the American Revolution, to quote the preeminent historian of American citizenship, James Kettner, "Americans repudiated the authority of Great Britain not as individuals, but as organized societies. Following the measures of the various colonies, independence was declared collectively by the representatives of the United States in General Congress assembled. After the many whereases of the Declaration of Independence, among them one that accused George III of having obstructed the laws of naturalization of foreigners and refusing to pass others to encourage migration to the colonies, its operative terms solemnly published and declared that these united colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, and that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown." Alison Lacroix just wrote a paper that was published as an occasional paper by the law school, in which he actually discusses very forcefully the fact that allegiance was not to the realm, not to the British state, it was to the crown. Immediately, the question arose how to deal with individuals who did not want to be part of the new allegiances. It had been one of the features of British oath legislation that individuals who were suspected of being dissidents could be tendered the oath. That is, they could be asked to take the oath for the purpose of clearing themselves. The same mechanism was employed in former colonies with respect to loyalists. For instance, in 1777, South Carolina passed an act establishing an oath of abjuration and allegiance for office holders and persons suspected of holding principles injurious to the rights of the state. The oath asked the juror to renounce, refuse, and abjure any allegiance or obedience to George III and to bear faith and true allegiance to South Carolina. Those who refused the oath were to be sent off to Europe or the West Indies at the public expense, unless they were able to pay their own way. As far as I know, this is the first American statute providing for deportation at public expense. Pennsylvania, dominated by Scots, Irish, Presbyterians and their Calvinist allies, was particularly extreme and initially conditioning a whole range of pursuits such as voting, the exercise of various occupations, use of the courts, and so on the taking of a loyalty oath. All white male inhabitants had to renounce their former oath to George III and pledge allegiance to the new state of Pennsylvania. One German, as if he had read Blackstone, I'm almost tempted to say as if he had read his Blackstone, as we normally would do, but Blackstone wasn't his. One German, is as if he had read Blackstone, refused on the ground that given his oath of allegiance to George III at the time of his naturalization, he might be deemed a perjurer if he renounced it. Moreover, he added, not unreasonably in view of the occupation of Philadelphia by the British, it is very uncertain upon which side the victory will fall. Therefore, I can't do it for the present time. The most significant aspect of the transformation of subjecthood to citizenship in the new United States was the fact that the latter was ordinarily acquired the same way the former had been, that is, not by choice, but by birth within the territory. With the exception of the immediate revolutionary period and its need to sort out the differences between patriots and loyalists through a right to elect one's allegiance, most citizens came by their citizenship and their allegiance due to the mere fact of having been born on American territory. If they were white, they were natural-born or birthright citizens. If the children of slaves, they were slaves. If Indians, they were quasi-foreigners. The terms natural-born and birthright generally refer to citizenship on account of territorial birth, the so-called jus soli. But the denotations of these terms, and definitely their connotations, also could cover citizenship by descent or parentage, the jus sanguinis. A statute from the reign of Queen Anne provided that the children of natural-born subjects born out of the legions of Her Majesty shall be deemed to be natural-born subjects to all intents and purposes whatsoever. The 1790 Naturalization Act introduced an equivalent rule for the United States. In general, citizenship continued to be mostly an involuntary personal characteristic. Lockean views about consent-based allegiance acquired operational significance primarily in the context of naturalization. Otherwise, Humean empiricism prevailed. The Constitution maintained silence on birthright citizenship until after the abolition of slavery by the 13th Amendment and following the 1866 Civil Rights Act, the 14th Amendment, with very limited exceptions, codified the jus soli. The very term naturalization, as used in British law, suggests that it places an alien in the same state as a natural-born subject. An imitation of nature, presumably in which consent replaces the accident of birth. In Great Britain, genuine naturalization, as distinguished from the lesser, royally conferred status of denizen that granted fewer rights, could ordinarily be accomplished only by an act of parliament, and even then, ineligibilities such as for parliament remain. It is hardly surprising that the newly independent states followed their own and British precedents as they contemplated the need to provide for naturalization. The solutions varied, but restricted to free white persons, had in common a residence and good character requirement and the taking of an oath of allegiance. The New York Constitution of 1776 left it to the discretion of the legislature to naturalize all such persons and in such manner as they thought proper. However, there was one constitutional proviso. All such persons as being born in parts beyond sea and out of the United States of America shall come to settle in and become subjects of this state, shall take an oath of allegiance to this state, and abjure and renounce all allegiance and subjection to all and every foreign king, prince, potentate, and state in all matters, ecclesiastical as well as civil. This requirement probably originated with John Jay, one of the framers of the New York Constitution. In a letter to Robert Livingston and Gouverneur Morris, Jay complained that the Constitutional Convention had failed to adopt an identical abjuration oath for office holders. The reference of the oath to ecclesiastical matters suggests an anti-Catholic end of the kind that was pursued by the supremacy oath under Elizabeth I. Also, that supremacy oath may have provided the model for the foreign authorities that New York lists for purposes of abjuration, foreign kings, princes, potentates, and states. The significance of citizenship in the early years was not too clear. Voting rights were controlled by the states and often a function of owning property or of taxpayer status rather than citizenship. The right to run for state office was, of course, a matter of state constitutional law, while the federal constitution imposed not insubstantial waiting periods for new citizens before new citizens could get elected to the House or Senate, 7 and 9 years respectively, and barred naturalized citizens such as the governor of California or me from becoming president. There were, however, various privileges and granted citizens. There were, however, various privileges granted citizens by protectionist federal legislation that played a significant role in the 1790 and 1795 debates concerning naturalization. A 1789 act that imposed duties on imports granted a 10% tariff reduction for goods imported in American-built and owned vessels. Under the Act concerning duties on tonnage, rates were 5 to 8 times higher for foreign vessels than for American-built and owned ships. As for the legislative motives for the 1795 Abjuration Oath, one can distinguish among ideological, commercial, and legal ones. The ideological motive for the oath may be seen in the insistence on more complete Americanization that it represented. Ideology was equally involved in the question what length apprenticeship, as it was called, might qualify foreigners to assume the character and discharge the duties of American citizens. there was a consensus that a longer time period was necessary than that required by the 1790 Act. What lapse of time could achieve this goal of acculturation by osmosis continued to be a subject of debate over many decades. But the method remained primarily osmosis. Since the knowledge of English was not required until 1906, many new citizens continue to live in the monolingual environments that had been Jefferson's nightmare. Ideologically, by 1795, many members of Congress were committed to a concept of American citizenship that stressed the unique nature of American government and therefore assumed a need for immigrants to make a choice, to start anew politically and sever all previous allegiances, even identities, in addition to getting acculturated. If the United States stood for a novus ordo seclorum, as the Great Seal says, a new order for the ages, then new Americans in particular needed to break with the old order. As prominent as these ideological concerns were, and they were, by the way, bipartisan, 1795 is not a case so much of Republicans against Federalists or the other way around. A little bit of that plays a role. As prominent as these ideological concerns were, abjuration also and importantly had commercial motives. Madison, who had been on an anti-British rampage all year, and who had worked himself into a frenzy concerning alleged British infiltration of American commerce, stressed the protectionist aspect of barriers to naturalization. I quote, "There was no class of emigrants from whom so much was to be apprehended as those who should obtain property in shipping. If he were disposed to make any distinction of one class of emigrants more than another as to the length of time before they should be admitted citizens, it would be as to the mercantile people, as these people, by possessing themselves of American shipping and seamen, be enabled clandestinely to favor such particular nations in the way of trade as they may think proper." Finally, in addition to ideological and commercial considerations in favor of the abjuration requirement, there were legal ones. A motion by James Hillhouse, a lawyer and treasurer of Yale College, that an American citizen who became the citizen of another country should not afterwards be readmitted as an American citizen, led to a lengthy analysis of expatriation by William Murray, a lawyer from Maryland who had received his legal education at the Inns of Court in London. Murray touched on a number of issues, including the role of the abjuration oath in confirming the rights of subjects and citizens to expatriate, or put differently, the position that there was no such thing as perpetual allegiance. Murray's argument had a double thrust. First, he emphatically took the position that there was a unilateral right to abjure one's allegiance. This was of importance also to the ongoing impressment controversy between the United States and Great Britain, in which Britain, on the basis of the doctrine of perpetual allegiance, claimed the right to impress those American seamen who had been British subjects before their naturalization. The controversy became a major contributor to the War of 1812. Second, Murray agreed with Hillhouse that as an alien, expatriated American citizens, an expatriated American citizen had no right of readmission to the United States. However, for Murray, all that meant was that the country could choose whether he should enjoy the privileges of citizenship again. With respect to those citizens who were naturalized Americans, John Locke's view loomed in the background. In the second treatise, Locke had, without further explanation, postulated that he who by actual agreement and express declaration has given his consent to be of any commonwealth is perpetually and indispensably obliged to be and remain unalterably a subject to it. I assume that underlying this once and for all proposition was Locke's view that express consent meant an explicit promise to obey a government. Once one had made such a promise, Locke did not allow further room for unilateral action. The House of Representatives saw it differently. It not only defeated the Hill House motion, but struck from the bill the requirement that aliens should forswear their allegiance to other states forever. It was Elias Boudinot of New Jersey who moved that the word be deleted, telling the story of a very respectable emigrant whose large fortune would very likely be of much use to the country, but who had assured Boudinot that rather than swallow such an oath, he would return to his own country. Boudinot of Huguenot stock used the occasion to throw cold water on the very idea of an oath of allegiance. He had always considered oaths of allegiance as an imposition. They might keep away men who had scruples because they had principles. Others would swear and break off when it suited them. The word forever implied that these people were not at liberty to return home and reassume the allegiance to their own country. What if the United States were to become a tyrannical government? Were people not to have the liberty of leaving it? Boudinot and others stated their vision of a country that would generate loyalty through what it had to offer. That is, apart from land, free and equal republican institutions. They were, as it were, followers of Frederick Jackson Turner before his time. On the other hand, Madison, and also many Federalists, were driven more by a nationalist perspective that considered it important to draw a distinct and sharp line between the United States and other countries. The language employed by the 1795 Abjuration Oath can hardly be viewed as tolerating fuzziness on the subject of citizenship. Permit me to fast forward. Following a wide variety of legal provisions and changes in naturalization and expatriation laws that began in earnest in 1906, Congress in 1940 further amended and codified then existing law. One of its goals at the time was to reduce the incidence of dual citizenship. The ideal, shared by many other countries, was that every person should have one nationality only. The entry on dual citizenship in the 1931 Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences included the assertion that dual nationality is essentially an incongruity. Or, as Peter Spiro puts it, dual citizenship was once thought of an offense against nature, an immoral status akin to bigamy. One might be a dual citizen by virtue of the interplay of different citizenship regimes, but one could not openly maintain allegiance to more than one nation. The 1940 Nationality Act contained a long list of events triggering expatriation. Inter alia, they included taking an oath of allegiance to a foreign state, holding office in a foreign government, voting in a foreign election, staying abroad during wartime to evade military service, and in the case of naturalized citizens, only residing for 3 years in one state of birth or for 5 years in any other foreign state. After initially, in the 1958 case of Perez against Brownell, upholding Congress's power to expatriate as an exercise of its power to regulate relations with foreign countries under the Necessary and Proper Clause, the court, less than 10 years later, overruled Perez and held 5-4 in Afroyim against Rusk that under the Constitution, Congress had no power to divest a citizen of his citizenship absent voluntary renunciation. Providing the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment with particular significance, Justice Black wrote, "The very nature of our free government makes it completely incongruous to have a rule of law under which a group of citizens temporarily in office can deprive another group of citizens of their citizenship. We hold that the 14th Amendment was designed to and does protect every citizen of this nation against a congressional forcible destruction of his citizenship, whatever his creed, color, or race. Our holding does no more than to give to the citizen that which is his own, a constitutional right to remain a citizen in a free country unless he voluntarily relinquishes that citizenship." Afroyim against Rusk was one of the Warren Court's more consequential, if poorly reasoned, landmarks. First of all, it made subjective intent to relinquish citizenship the core issue. As Spiro puts it, today there is no activity, including office holding and military service, that will by itself result in expatriation. Secondly, the decision, in conjunction with an ever-spreading acceptance of dual citizenship on the part of other countries, had the effect of providing individuals with choices that they had not previously enjoyed to such a full extent. In short, if the doctrine of perpetual allegiance once stood for the proposition that an individual cannot unilaterally break the ties to a given society, the Supreme Court made perpetual allegiance to mean that the United States cannot unilaterally terminate citizenship. An expatriating act without the intent to relinquish citizenship does not expatriate. In administrative law, as expressed in an advisory about possible loss of citizenship on the State Department's website, a place where one now goes to find administrative law, this reads as follows. A person who is naturalized in a foreign country, a person who, one, is naturalized in a foreign country, two, takes a routine oath of allegiance to a foreign state, three, serves in the armed forces of a foreign state not engaged in hostilities with the United States, or four, accepts non-policy level employment with a foreign government and in so doing wishes to retain U.S. citizenship, need not submit prior to the commission of a potentially expatriating act a statement or evidence of his or her intent to retain U.S. citizenship, since such an intent will be presumed. The concept of volitional allegiance has acquired a meaning that until quite recently would have been unimaginable. The way the State Department website deals with dual citizenship is simply to say, U.S. law does not mention dual citizenship or require a person to choose one citizenship or another. The State Department lawyers wisely do not pause to explain the meaning of to renounce in the abjuration oath. Anecdotal evidence would show citizens need not restrict themselves to dual citizenship. As people go about diversifying their citizenship portfolios, they easily may end up with multiple citizenships. The notion of a cosmopolitan citizen has acquired a self-interested reality. The development is a worldwide one. Many countries have come to accept dual citizenship. In some instances, such as Ireland and Mexico, they have actively embraced it for political reasons. In a mostly conscription-free age, individuals are not so much concerned with what Chief Justice Ellsworth called the folly of contracting contradictory obligations, but with maximizing rights, including economic ones. It is not so much allegiance that is on their minds, but the benefits conferred by a foreign passport. For instance, an American who is a dual citizen of any one of the 27 member states of the European Union will benefit from the freedoms and the non-discrimination rules of the EU in its entire territory. These privileges, in turn, have created an EU citizenship, in quotes perhaps, that is of increasing importance to the EU's population of almost 500 million. The naturalization oath that is required by Section 337 of the Immigration and Nationality Act now reads as follows. I hereby declare on oath that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty of whom or which I have heretofore been a subject or citizen. That I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That I will bear arms on behalf of the United States when required by the law. That I will perform non-combatant service in the armed forces of the United States when required by the law. That I will perform work of national importance under civilian direction when required by the law. And that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation. Is this, to quote the peculiar State Department term, a routine oath of allegiance? Or should we think of a person who, the day after having taken the abjuration oath, goes to the consulate of his or her country of origin to obtain a new passport as a documented but somewhat illegal citizen, perhaps a perjurer? The abjuration oath does not have a perjury penalty attached to it, and in practice, the government does not enforce it. Instead, it is winking, and so are many of the jurors. On the one hand, there is a duty absolutely and entirely to renounce all prior allegiances. On the other hand, there is a constitutionally derived, if somewhat grudgingly granted, conflicting liberty to hold several citizenships simultaneously. If one takes with Oliver Wendell Holmes the view of our friend the bad man, there is no antinomy, since the courts and indeed the legal system as a whole will do nothing about violations of the abjuration oath. A problem exists only for those potential citizens who conscientiously will rather forgo naturalization than forswear allegiance. Given this unattractive situation, should the unenforced abjuration oath simply be abolished? Whenever possible, government should not send confusing signals, conflicting messages. It should speak clearly and forthrightly. Government should also never be found in the proximity of what might be misunderstood as subornation of perjury, or for that matter, of its own allegiance. All of this suggests to me that we would be well advised to eliminate the abjuration element from the oath of allegiance as reflecting old principles which the nation has outgrown. Yet, given our incapacity to develop sensible, honest, and efficient immigration policies in general, it may be impossible to add the symbol-laden question of dual citizenship to the agenda, especially since, except for a few scholars and polemicists, there has been almost no public discussion of the topic. The fact that the topic especially involves our immediate neighbors, Mexico and Canada, both of which now allow dual citizenship, does not make debate any easier. Assuming that nothing will be done, let me employ a heuristic device of my invention that takes a commonsensical view of the abjuration requirement against the background of present American policies. Since neither law nor the meaning of legal terms are immutable, we would be well served to remember Justice Holmes's elegant formulation, "A word is not a crystal, transparent and unchanged. It is the skin of a living thought and may vary greatly in color and content according to the circumstances and the time in which it is used." Suppose I were a federal judge. My apologies, Diane. I'm a federal district judge, of course. Suppose I, my apologies to you also, Abner. Suppose I were a federal judge officiating at a naturalization ceremony. In addition to whatever else serious and uplifting there is to be said at such occasions, I might go on to state the following. You are about to take an oath of allegiance that makes you renounce allegiance to other countries of which you are a citizen. This requirement is almost as old as the Constitution of the United States. At the time of its adoption, the world was mostly made up of princely regimes. Republican governments were few. Democracies hardly existed. The potential for, indeed the reality of, conflict over which person belonged to which country was widespread. The framers of the abjuration oath wanted to minimize that conflict. However, they also wanted to make sure that those who, like you, entered into an agreement with the people of the United States would sincerely attach themselves to the principles of the Constitution of the United States and would be well disposed to its good order and happiness, as the law then said. The desire and the need of the United States for this commitment, this allegiance, has not changed since the 18th century. What has changed is that our country, in recent decades, has recognized a right on the part of individual citizens to maintain more than one citizenship. Some would prefer it if you had only the citizenship of the United States. However, if for sentimental or other reasons you decide to carry another passport, you are doing nothing illegal. The forswearance of allegiance that the oath still demands nowadays means to indicate to you that the obligations you take on, are a very serious matter, as is your commitment to participate in the governance of our country, to become one of the people. For purposes of governance, you cannot and you should not serve two masters. What I've been trying to accomplish with this little discourse is to adapt the venerable oath to the present constitutional context by preserving as much of the commitments of its framers as possible. The abjuration requirement may be viewed as emphasizing that admission to citizenship, in particular the right to participate in legislative deliberations, the right to vote, the right to become a legislator in the broadest sense of the word, involves a choice. Looked at it this way, what matters in forswearance is not the denotative meaning of the act, but the connotations it signifies about the importance of what John Locke called the legislator. And I ask your permission, as I conclude, to quote John Locke, perhaps a little too romantic for our present understanding of the legislative process, but still saying something very important, I think. "Civil society being a state of peace amongst those who are of it, from whom the state of war is excluded by the umpirage which they have provided in their legislative for the ending of all differences that may arise amongst any of them. It is in their legislative that the members of the Commonwealth are united and combined together in one coherent living body. This is the soul that gives form, life, and unity to the Commonwealth. From hence, the several members have their mutual influence, sympathy, and connection. Of course, none of these sentiments have been or will be subject to enforcement. We are dealing here with virtue, with voluntary observance of standards of right conduct. What can be and will be enforced are the laws promulgated by the legislative. That enforcement will in any event take place regardless of abjuration. Furthermore, if the government of the United States, to adapt Noah Webster, is no better than that of his or her home country, the naturalized citizen will be influenced by partialities in spite of any solemn enunciation of a foreign power. To my mind, John Page, a member of the First Congress and later governor of Virginia, had it right when he expressed the view that good citizenship was a function of having good laws. Page shall have the last word. It is nothing to us whether Jews or Roman Catholics settle amongst us, whether subjects of kings or citizens of free states wish to reside in the United States. They will find it in their interest to be good citizens. And neither their religion nor political opinions can injure us if we have good laws well executed. Thank you for your attention.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.